history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some seemingly ordinary Americans around you who have extraordinary stories to tell. Sometimes all it takes is a little bit of time to listen, and that's what we try to provide here each week. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We've heard from a lot of Pearl Harbor survivors over the years from coast to coast, and as we close in on the 75th anniversary of that date, which has indeed lived in infamy, we're going to hear from more of them in the weeks ahead. Very rarely on Hometown Heroes do we extend one veteran story over two episodes, but we're in that situation today. If you missed the first part of 95-year-old Delton Wally Walling's story, you can hear it and any other episode online at hometownheroesradio.com. Wally told us why he had one of his fingers removed to get into the Navy, what he witnessed the morning of December 7th from an observation tower overlooking Pearl Harbor, and why he goes back there every year, spending hours and hours visiting the people who come from all over the world to tour the USS Arizona Memorial. Those intense minutes he endured there so many years ago have in many ways shaped his life, and eventually Pearl Harbor will be his final resting place.
You've decided that when you're no longer here, you want your ashes to be spread on the USS Utah.
Yes.
Why did you decide that?
The Utah is a forgotten ship at Pearl Harbor. It's supposed to be kept up, everything, just like the Arizona. But because it's over on the other side, on Fort Allen, over next to the Aviation Museum, it's neglected. I donate and help take care. So I take money down with me, and I give it to the people that's maintaining, so I know where it's going. That is the reason that I want to be buried there, instead of off in the Arizona. It's a place where you can get to it. You can drive right over there to it now. So we take care of a lot of burials there.
So and it's so kind of your way of...
I want to be there with my people that left me many years ago. I can't be buried in the Utah because I was not on the Utah.
Right.
I can be... My ashes are buried in the water.
When you go back there and you take that little boat ride out to the Arizona, does that ever get old? You've done it so many times.
It never gets old. Never gets old. See, I'm on that boat going out there. When that boat stops, they hold everybody aboard. I go first and go in and go and say my prayers for the 1,171 that perished on that day. And then they let the people in behind me. You cannot stop. If I stop, they're sunk. The schedule is all throughout.
Right.
I got to keep moving.
There's so many people that want to talk to you.
And you can't stop.
Yeah.
No matter where I go in Honolulu today, we stop it.
Yet, you continue to go back because you realize that that role you play, even though I'm sure that's difficult sometimes, to have the stamina to deal with that many people, that there's an importance and a value to what you're doing there. When you look down at the water and you see those tears of oil come to the surface, what do you think about?
I can't really tell you how you feel. I really can't.
You know those guys are still down there.
I know those men are still there.
Yeah. You said that you do what you do to make sure the true story of Pearl Harbor is told. What is the lesson of Pearl Harbor? Why is it important 75 years later to still honor and remember that day?
Vigilance. Vigilance. Today, you're not paying attention. The people down the street, they don't want to get in there. They want to say something. Look what's happened. Everything that's happened in New York, it could have been stopped if they'd have said something to somebody. You cannot possibly stop this, what's happening, unless everybody gets in the act. And there's so many people that have a son or something that's a little off, and they don't want to tell about their son or whatever.
Sure.
You will never stop this. You'll never stop. You can fight ISIS in an army, but you cannot. They call this ISIS over here. It's terrorism.
So the lesson is Americans need to be alert.
You bet. You bet. One thing we didn't talk about here mm-hmm. is the Nevada.
Yeah.
The Nevada is the only ship that got underway.
Right.
The battleship.
Yeah.
And they got underway, and by going slowly, they can be hit with everything going. And when they backed away and backed into the pipeline across there and knocked that out and got into that, that's when we recognized that they were going to come out. When they started up that channel, man, we told Kimmel, you know, about it. He's going to stop that as quick as he can. Yeah, but it takes a little time to get to the ships that's being bombed and everything. And so they never got to it until it was right out in front of us. And by the time they got out there, you couldn't even see that ship from the fire and everything's on it.
Wow.
And we got to get it grounded. So we finally got through to them, and they run into ground at Hospital Point there.
Mm-hmm.
And that saved the channel from being blocked.
That's the important point, that if the Nevada had been stuck in the opening to the channel, then everybody's a sitting duck.
Set, yeah. And not only that, how long would it take before you could ever get a ship out of it
right.
or in?
Yeah, you're trapped.
See, that's a narrow channel right up there.
And you guys were involved in that communication?
Yeah, sure.
To let them know what to do or where to go.
But they was being hit so bad. I couldn't see. Well, of course, our captain and everyone's killed, you know, on the Nevada. I couldn't see how they could stay afloat very long.
Of all the things you saw then in December of 1941, is there one thing to you that was the most inspirational or motivating?
If you look down and see everything gone in front of you, how are you going to try to figure out which direction are we going? We don't know the full strength of the Japanese.
Of all the times that you've been back there on Oahu, and all these people, I mean, you've met admirals and generals and politicians and people from all over the world. Is there one thing that somebody said to you that really meant the most to you?
Boy, you really hit me, because I really can't say.
Too much. Too many.
Too much.
Yeah.
I'm in a different world when I get into Pearl Harbor. Just has to be, because that's where it all started.
What keeps you going back there every year? I mean, you've dealt with cancer. You're 95 years old. What keeps you going?
Because I want the story told as long as it can be. And it's going to stop very shortly.
And like so many of the guys I talk to, you don't like that word hero being thrown around.
No. 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 No way.
Why not?
Because my kids that was right with me there, they're heroes. They came back, but they're heroes to me. They're my heroes because they done everything right.
The sailors who are under your command.
Yes.
Yeah.
I had no problem.
Uh-huh.
They are my heroes, but not to heroes to everybody else because they come home.
What does that say about the guys who didn't come home? 406,000 Americans in World War II.
406, but 110,000 out of the Pacific.
Uh-huh.
They're my heroes. Because they gave me the freedom that I have enjoyed mm-hmm. for the past 75 years. I helped bury so many. They are my heroes. And they deserve everything that they can possibly get and their families.
You ever go to the punch bowl when you're out there?
Oh, yes. I used to run the tours through there because I made most all of the invasions of the Pacific.
Well, let's talk about that. So, and we've been talking about Pearl Harbor for so long here, but you spent a lot more time after Pearl Harbor in the Navy than you did leading up to it.
Oh, yeah.
So you went on an APA, an
APA
attack transport? APA
43. Uh-huh. Fayette, USS Fayette. We took it to the Pacific, and my first invasion was Kwajalein. You must remember that before the war started in World War II, we had never made a landing with craft. We didn't know how to do it.
Right.
So Tarawa was your first big mistake.
Yep.
We did not get the right information, the intelligence that we needed to attack.
Because of the coral reefs that you got hung up on?
The coral reefs and the barriers that protected.
Uh-huh.
And so that was a terrible, terrible mistake. But we got to learn. And so every time that you make it, you learn something else until you get it to perfection, like you did on the Normandy, you know. Look what would have happened if we'd have, right off the war, we'd have had to make a landing on Normandy. So we learned.
So your
time.
First one is Kwajalein. So there's Army guys in the south, there's Marines in the north at Roy Namur as part of that. Where were you?
We was on the south end.
And so your ship has a bunch of LCVPs, Higgins boats.
20-some.
That take the Marines or the Army into shore.
Because all these islands in Kwajalein is only 6 foot high out of the water.
Uh-huh.
They could be hit with everything, not like the mountainous islands.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't even really know where we was at. We were sitting there in the dark in the morning, and all at once we hear a siren go off. We know there's guns going to be going off pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing you know, behind us is all the battle wagons sitting behind, shooting right over the top of us onto the island. And man, that island's lighting up. And we found out real quick, don't get on the other side of that island when they're low islands, because the big shells will come in and bounce off and liable to hit you out there on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know that until then. Luckily, we didn't have any hit. But boy, after it got daylight, the ship's cleared out from that other side if you're flying across there.
I believe it. And your job on the Fayette is communications.
Just communications.
So what does that mean? What kind of communications are you handling?
We're handling, during the war, up until the Marianas turkey shoot, everything was done by flag. Maneuvering of all the ships was done by flag. And when I had a squadron of ships to take care of, I put out the signals every afternoon at 4 o'clock in the afternoon for everything we're going to do at night. And all the turns and everything is done by the clock right on the second. Now, what's amazing to me, that we never cracked up a ship in the middle of the night.
Well, I was going to say.
Why didn't, with all the ships that we had out there, why didn't we sooner or later crack up somebody?
Well, that's what I was going to say. That's a lot of responsibility on your shoulders. You better get those signals right, or else somebody could die.
In the afternoon, the admiral and his staff are deciding what's going to be done during the night.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they decide, then they bring up the written message of what they want done. Now, then I go ahead and put them into the flags and run them up. And this is how it's done. I'm the OTC. I'm the lead ship in this squadron of 30. I run up the signal. I don't two-block it. I don't take it all the way up. Leave it down 6 feet. And then every ship back behind me, clear back, five or six ships in each line, they run it up, but they leave it down until the last ship in that line understands that signal. Now, when he understands that signal, he two blocks it, the next one two blocks it, and it comes back to me, so I know that whole line of ships understand the message.
Got it.
Of what's going to be done. Now, I wait till everybody is all understand it, and then I pull it down, and that signal is executed for it to be handled later at night. Or it might be a signal that you're going to do immediately.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to change a fleet course and a fleet axis on guide to right to 060 simultaneous, that's going to be done in about 30 seconds because you got planes coming in and you run that in the air and everybody better get on to it immediately.
There's a lot that you can communicate in a flag.
What? You can tell any message there is. And that book is that thick.
And I wonder how many people really understand that, because it's so foreign to what we have now. I mean, you've got a smartphone, you've got an iPad, you can pull up all your pictures from Pearl Harbor the last 2 years, but 70 years ago, you're taking a flag and communicating pretty complex messages.
That's right. See, the whole fleet, up until the Marianas turkey shoot, when the Japanese decided that they'd take us on the last time, but what they didn't know was how fast we could build carriers, and they didn't know how many carriers we had there. So they come down with their five carriers to destroy us, but we had 14 there, and they walked right into it. 370-some planes of the Japanese and the Flyers was destroyed at the Marianas turkey shoot.
Right.
In fact, over all the decades since, they've actually upped those numbers. Estimates now are that potentially 600 Japanese airplanes were destroyed during the Marianas Turkey shoot, the aerial side of the Battle of the Philippine Sea in June of 1944. But before and after that, there were other things that Wally Walling experienced that I don't think he'll ever forget, including his perspective on the brutal battle for Iwo Jima. We'll touch on that and more when we come back. For photos, videos, and links to other stories about Wally, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.